Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, we continue our special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing. This is, colloquially speaking, our living white male show, and with Norman Mailer, E.L. Doctorow, and Russell Banks, we attempt to trace the path from a felt loss of centrality to a new embrace of diversity. Norman Mailer, born in 1923, published his first novel, The Naked and the Dead, in 1948, years before the rise of identity politics and multiculturalism. I spoke with him about his book, The Spooky Art, Thoughts Upon Writing, published in his 80th year.
You see, I think of myself as being part of a generation that knows what a hallucinogenic jolt prose by Norman Mailer packs.
As you write, I found what keeps you going is that you have to stay fresh. And one of the things I have is I'm getting a lot older. I may never be able to catch that kind of prose again. I am the equivalent of an old athlete, very old athlete. And they tend to get by more on their secondary gifts when they get old, their lore, their canniness, their experience, their subtlety, their humor. And they recognize that they're, whatever, 90, 80, 70% as gifted athletically as they used to be. And so they have to make up for it with other things. And I thought, maybe I can still write a major novel. But if I can't, and the odds have to be at best 50-50, maybe less, I want something out there that shows another side of me, which is how much I've thought about writing all these years.
In one of the new sections of The Spooky Art, you say this, and I loved it. I wanted to read it out loud and talk about it a little bit. It's a conversation, part of a conversation about evil, the banality of evil, and
well, excuse me for interrupting, but I loathe Hannah Arendt's notion of the banality of evil. Okay.
And this is the argument against the idea of the banality of evil. And Kierkegaard is enlisted in the counter-argument. He was ready to suggest that at the moment we're feeling most saintly, we may in fact be evil. And that moment, when we think we're most evil and finally corrupt, we might, by the startling judgment of God, be considered saintly. The value of this notion is that it strips us of the fundamental arrogance of assuming that at any given moment, any of us has enough centrality, that is, possesses a seat from which we can expound our dogma or determine our moral value. I may have a fairly well-formed cloud of intuitions about the nature of the good, and like a cloud, it has, to a certain degree, its structure. Yet the form is capable of altering quickly. A cloud changes shape over a few moments, but it remains a cloud. It's not just simply an unformed chaos. That, I would propose, is as close as we get to any moral truth. This is why I love the novel. It is, I would repeat, the form best suited for developing our moral sensitivity, which is to say our depth of understanding rather than our rush to judgment. Given the complexity of the last century and the surrealistic knockdowns of the first 2 years of this century, quick judgment has become a need analogous to the kind of all-consuming hunger that is ready to eat grass and dirt to fill the void or go to McDonald's.
Now, hey, thank you for reading that. I was reading, I was thinking, hey, that writer's not bad.
That was Norman Mailer. E.L. Doctorow's breakthrough novel, Ragtime, was published in 1974. It pitted its immigrant and African-American characters against the genteel American family, a meeting ground that becomes a battlefield. I spoke with him upon the publication of his most recent book, Sweetland Stories, and he spoke of his new cast of characters, the transient underclass that can be found all over America.
The book is, to my mind, a whole new event in the Doctorow world
in that these stories seem to me to be about the kind of people who are American heroes only within the last 7 or 8 or 10 years. Their stories have been previously in tabloids. In a way, I know some folk songs about some of these types. There's one about Mrs. Dyer, the wretched baby farmer, a British folk song, and one of these women in Sweetland Stories has a house on the plains in which, to which she inveigles old bachelors, people with money, and you know, like the widows in Arsenic and Old Lace, she and her son bury them there. I think this is a book about Americans and their desperate attempt to fail to put a family together.
That's interesting. They're sort of loose gravel, aren't they, these people? And it is true that women are the dominant characters in these stories. In the one story, if not the dominant character, then certainly the catalyst for the action in two stories. But I've been thinking, you know, once you finish writing something, then you begin to think about it, as a reader does. And you remember that book in the 1920s in Winesburg, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
where he simply went through this town and reported on the various degrees of almost pathological loneliness. It was a study of what provincial life in America was like in that period. Well, we're not the provinces anymore, and the people in these stories are spread out all over the country. They're sort of born transients. They're always from somewhere else, wherever they alight. And the pathology there is not of the provinces, but of a kind of rootlessness that it gives them a certain kind of national identity somehow for me, if not a town identity. I see all these people as trying to perfect their lives somehow. Even from, I mean, in that first story, the terrible things they do, always with a sense of righteousness and improving their station in life, as evil is often very self-righteous. But there again, that attempt to perfect what they're given and make something of it seems to be characteristic of all these characters. There is a kind of seeking among all these people, which may not be total redemption for them. They all, in doing this, sort of create a universe around themselves. The sense I have of the self created universe encapsulating their lives in which they've created and they live within it very often with very bad results. But you know, when you write fiction, you don't choose things. They come to you and you serve them, the ideas, the images, whatever it is. You're not a sociologist, you're not an anthropologist, you're not a politician. You're not a theologian, but you can participate in all the vocabularies that they generate as a way of finding whatever it is you're looking for in your own fiction.
That was E.L. Doctorow. Russell Banks was born in 1940. Searching for Survivors, his first novel, was published in 1974. I thought it would be interesting to have Russell Banks as a guest during our series of Identity, because from his very beginnings as a writer, he's been in the interzones of identity as well as of literature. He began, in some sense, working with small presses, among them the Fiction Collective. He has written in many forms, both blue-collar realism and avant-garde post-metafiction. And so what I think that Russell Banks has known is that the mind does not know
individual identity, nor is it comfortable with mono vocal forms of expression. He's the author of Cloud Splitter, Rule of the Bone, The Sweet Hereafter, Affliction, Success Stories, Continental Drift, The Relation of My Imprisonment, and many of these books, like his newest book, The Darling, take place in double settings, a place where the person is born and the place where a person often chooses or needs to be, a counter environment. And I wanted to begin by asking you, do you sense yourself as a writer needing a stable identity?
Well, I don't think of it quite as a double identity. I think from the beginning, or at least early on in my writing life, I began to locate myself in what I think of as borderlands. I live on the borders, literally, border between Canada and the United States, and I've spent most of my adult life either on the border between Florida and the Caribbean or the northern border of the United States in a very literal and physical sense. But I've always felt as though I was on the borders of identity between other human beings, between men and women, between white people and black people, between Americans and non-Americans, between adults and children. In a sense, this is the location of my imagination. And I've mapped it out over the, now what, 40 years or more of writing. I've mapped out a territory, in a way, that is on the borders. I'm most comfortable there. I think I'm most intelligent there. I feel most authentic there, in a paradoxical way, than when I have one locatable identity, let's say as a white male American man from the northeastern United States. I mean, I don't feel comfortable with one identity. I feel authentic and comfortable when I'm moving between identities.
You have become the author of these novels, which is to say that you've laid claim to many identities. There are those who see you in Affliction as a spokesperson for Broken Sons, in Continental Drift as the person who is leaving, in a sense, Huck-wise or Ishmael-wise, his own culture for the world that he prefers. When you have, as an individual, taken on these expansions, what happens to the identity you present a public?
Oh, well, that's such a complicated question, and it's one that the answer to which is out of my control altogether. You know, when I taught for many years, I used to try to reduce most of what I was teaching to a simple maxim, which was keep your work and your career separate. Never worry about your career because you can't control it. The only thing you can control is your work. Concentrate on that. And so you're asking, in a sense, about my career, about my public identity, how I might be perceived through the media or...
And in particular, how it's changed you, because you've brought into focus different aspects of the self in book after book. Each book seems to be a different part of the identity.
Yeah, but Michael, I don't think my public identity has changed me in that regard. I think that the books themselves, writing the books themselves, is what's changed me. Each book has expanded my consciousness in that old-fashioned phrase and in that old-fashioned sense and altered my consciousness such that it allowed me to write the next book. The Darling has probably done something similar to me, too. I've told, in this case, for the first time in a book-length project, a story about a woman's life, a woman my age, a late middle-aged woman, a white American woman, radical. And that's, I'm sure, altered what I'll do next.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Russell Banks. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Russell Banks.
I know many readers for whom Continental Drift was a real turning point in their reading experience. Why? Because something that's inherent in the national identity, Thoreau going to Walden Pond, was reinvented in fiction to not just retiring from a culture, but leaving it entirely and entering a new one.
Mm-hmm. That's the American dream, isn't it?
Yes, it's a breakthrough possibility.
Yeah.
And there's this book, at the same time that the culture is hunkering down on identity, that's saying that you can transcend identity, that it's almost as malleable as what we discovered about transgenders.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in terms of representing in literature something new in the concept of world citizenship, that you may be the actual citizen of a place you were not born, and that you may have been born with a sense of identities manifested elsewhere, as if you have to roam the globe to find your home. It wasn't given. That seems to me that you've entered a mythic identity for readers. I'm not talking about anything casual like career. I'm talking about the invocation of archetype and myth.
Yeah, well, that's, of course, what one reaches for. You try to find the imagery, you try to find the metaphors, the tale, and the characters that will take you to that configuration that we call narrative, but which is, in fact, myth. And that's what interests me. And also, the malleability of myth is what interests me as well. And when national myths get frozen, get fixed, and are no longer attacked, confronted, altered, modified, revised by the people. And, of course, I'm speaking by writers, because this is what writers do. They both create and then deconstruct and then recreate myths. When that's, you know, that to me is an essential role for the writer. And if you can't do that, if you have no interest or understanding of that possibility, then you're not doing what I'm trying to do, and or what every writer I've ever admired has tried to do.
Which is
to recreate, extend, and test our mythologies, whether it's the mythology of family, the mythology of class, the mythology of race, the mythology of national identity, the mythology of gender identity, sexual identity. We have a series of narratives which explain these puzzles, these conundrums to us, and they have to be constantly confronted and constantly not updated, but overturned and restated in terms that allow us to begin to understand ourselves as human beings again. But you know what happens, Michael, as you go along in life, you know this, you're old enough now to realize this, that the themes that obsess you and the questions that preoccupy you stay with you. And to the degree that you answer them, they become part of the braided quality of your own reality, your own conscious and unconscious reality. And so it isn't as though I've just moved from that theme on to the next theme. Rather, I've dragged them along with me. I can use that as a building block and use it as a way of pushing myself further into another area that I will try to braid back into the rope that I guess is where what I can call my own personal identity.
I'm speaking to Russell Banks, whose most recent novel is The Darling and whose collected stories came out in a big volume called Angel on the Roof. Now, at the same time as there is the culture of literature, which grows and accretes, and not just in each writer's work, but in a nation's literature, there is the cultural climate in which we live that has been practically howling at writers to create hegemonies. You and Joyce Carol Oates in particular are the primary, it seems to me, white American violators of that insistence that we stay in a personal neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you to talk to me about that. I don't even know the question that informs mm-hmm. it, but it does seem to me that if there were a writer's bill of rights, you would be demanding the right to enter other existences mm-hmm. that are telling you, we own these, you stay home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. The territoriality of identity politics, which seems to me not just wrong-headed, but dangerous, and for various reasons. I mean, you have to ask, who does it serve? Follow the money, that sort of thing.
Who does it serve?
Well, hegemony of identity of any kind serves marketing principles, basically. It's niche marketing. There's an economic use for it. There's a political use for it. You can target those voters with one speech. You know exactly how to do it. You can target the other voters with another speech, and you can bring them into your party. So I think, yeah, political and economic, and I think that writers themselves are often misled by it and manipulated by it, by identity politics, and then they end up serving it. For sometimes not so great reasons, economic reasons of their own, after all, guarantees them an audience. You know what section of the bookstore you're going to go into. But also, more often the case, innocent and fearful reasons, reasons of rejection, fear of probably to fear of being accused of the kind of appropriation and violation that you've been describing here. I can't say I'm not sensitive to that, because I am. I mean, I'm aware of the fact that my work will be read with a certain amount not antagonism necessarily, but suspicion by this book, particularly by women. And that, in order for me to meet that suspicion and overcome it, I'm going to have to write do a certain amount of work that I don't have to do if I'm writing about a white man of late middle age who had a slightly radical political past and ended up living a life he never expected. I don't have to do too much homework for that particular character, but I do have to do a lot of homework for the darling. And is this another exercise in white privilege?
Mm. Is literature another exercise in white privilege, or rather, to what extent might literature become an exercise in privilege?
That's a tricky question.
But I think it's at the heart of a lot of the fear of literature that goes on. To what extent are we privileged to speak for others or to others? And to what extent does the imagination empower us to do so?
I've always felt suspicious of taking on to myself a certain kind of narrator. It's probably why I write so often in the first person. And that's the narrator I'm speaking of is that third-person authorial presence, you know, who has the kind of entitlement, as it seems to me.
The know-it-all.
Yeah, the know-it-all, to tell us what people are thinking and doing when no one is around to witness it. That I've always felt a little uncomfortable with that.
So you're on a campaign against omniscience in a whole lot of different ways.
Yeah, I guess so. You could put it, I wouldn't call it quite a campaign, but I know whenever I come up against that possibility as a writer, not as a reader, I haven't got as much problem with it as a reader, I feel rather uncomfortable taking that role on. I love being a storyteller in a very rudimentary, almost primitive sense. I understand the world best through stories, reading and writing stories. I understand other people best through story. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about a very specific technical approach to storytelling. Because it does correspond to some of the questions. I was moral questions that I was
really
addressing
moral
earlier.
Questions. Yeah. You were asked some 3 years ago to become the president of an organization called Cities of Asylum. This organization attempts to make a home in different American cities for persons
worldwide. Yeah.
Worldwide, yeah, right. Yes. But your branch is America.
It is now. Yep.
Yeah. For writers who have been persecuted. In other words, it's the opposite situation to most of your narratives, where a writer is leaving his culture to go elsewhere. You are helping people to come here and find a home in this alternative culture.
Yeah, or you could say that I'm trying to ease the leaving of writers, of other writers, from in such a way that it's not cruel and unhappy and or even life-threatening. I mean, most of the writers, obviously, all the writers who are able to benefit from the Cities of Asylum project are writers who were forced to leave their language, their culture, their geography, their families, their friends, who were forced into exile. But there is a sense in which, maybe this addresses the question, sense in which all writers are exiled. All writers live on the borders and float through them, and the borders of between human beings and the borders, geographic and political borders as well, and owe no allegiance to any national, linguistic, cultural, or familial identity in that sense.
I've been speaking to Russell Banks, the author most recently of The Darling, which has been published by HarperCollins. But Russell, thank you very, very much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure.
This interview has been taped in the library at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe. My guest technician has been Mickey Brown.
The producers of Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing are Michael Silverblatt, Melinda Siegel, and Alan Howard. The engineer is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week when our special series will continue on Bookworm.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books. Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.